what I'm realizing is that diseases are almost like an elephant, and all the subspecialties are close to that elephant. Nobody sees it completely. Nobody really backs away from the elephant to see the total problem. Somebody sees the tusk, somebody sees the bum, somebody sees the side. And the question is, who will adjudicate what needs to be done to you as a patient? It needs to be connected.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. Holistic care, connected care, integrated care. There are a lot of buzzwords for what some people think is a long overdue shift from a healthcare system organized around visits to one organized around patient journeys and outcomes. This will take a massive shift in approach, and in many cases, startups are leading the way. Startups like Omada, Nest, CityBlock, and Homeward, who we have already featured on this podcast. Today, we're bringing you a conversation with Fred Khosravi, a serial entrepreneur, inventor, and builder who has founded more than 20 companies and holds hundreds of patents. And now, with Imperative Care, he's bringing this kind of integrated and holistic approach to stroke care. Fred also has a really compelling personal story. He came to the U.S. alone from Iran at 17, and we talked about how that early experience shaped his appetite for risk, sense of purpose, and how he approaches entrepreneurship. This is my second episode recorded live and in person at the J.P. Morgan Berkeley Healthcare Conference in Taipei. So please welcome Fred Khosravi to The Other 80. It's really wonderful to have you on the show. I feel like my brain is going a mile a minute with all the conversations that have been happening over the last couple of days. I'm wondering, is there something that's been sticking with you from what we've been talking about here in Taipei?
Well, Claudia, first of all, I really appreciate being invited to do this with you. It's a great honor. First and foremost, and this is not an advertisement, but I think doing this conference in Taipei is pretty extraordinary. The thing that I'm recognizing about Taiwan in general, that's at the governmental level, at the finance level, at the technology and innovation level, and in industrial level, basically, is that there is a striving for being more of a place that is known for its currency of trust. I see this in every corner of this small country of, I think, 23 million people. But I think it's very exciting to have people to build on the nobility of the culture that comes from the 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years old Confucius thinking, but one is also based on care, based on togetherness, based on creating an environment where people can trust the person next to them, that they would actually respect their rights and their aspirations. And it's exciting. I think it's an extraordinary environment, by the way, from my perspective, for healthcare, in the sense that if you are going to build a high-quality platform for healthcare innovation in the future, you need a healthcare system that is uncorrupted as possible.
I spent a lot of time talking to innovators and investors in the U.S., but most of whom don't have a global investment portfolio. And I think for me, just being outside the bubble of the U.S., even though it's a very large bubble, has been very refreshing. In your story, you came to the U.S. from Iran on one of the last flights after Bloody Tuesday, and you've had a remarkable career of entrepreneurship since that time. And I'm wondering how that beginning again and the leaving everything behind might have shaped your attitude or your appetite for risk, and also how you show up as an entrepreneur. How do those two things fit together for you?
So I was 17 years old when I arrived in the U.S. without anyone, any members of my family, so to speak. And the next time I actually got to see the members of my family, I was a 42-year-old man with gray hair from 17. But I was very closely in touch with them. Those of my friends who actually stayed ended up participating in the Iran-Iraq war. Many people that I know perished as a result of the skirmishes between Iran and Iraq that essentially took about 1 million lives, by the way. For me, America was a respite. But I also have to say, in this world of backlash against immigration, almost nobody who immigrates really wants to immigrate. I think probably most everybody who immigrates, they would prefer to actually be able to live in their own place that they grew up in. It's a hard decision to make to immigrate. For me as a 17-year-old, it was difficult to make the decision, and it was an emotional burden for several years, basically. When the day was over and I would go back to my dorm room, I would just kind of be under the blanket and cry. And this went on for years in the process. So nobody really wants to immigrate. Being blessed that I was not in the middle of war, I actually recognized at the time. Several years later, I realized that there was something else that I felt blessed about. And this is the ability to actually come to a place where I could consume the education that I wanted to consume without anybody dictating what education I needed to consume. Coming from a place where education is fed into you. And if you don't consume that education that's actually fed into you, there are horrible consequences for it.
It hardly feels like education at that point.
Well, interestingly, I was a horrible student. I remind myself that education for somebody like me was not digestible, was not consumable. So I was just like keeping my mouth closed and not letting any of it get into me. When I came to the U.S. and I was able to actually have 100% freedom of studying what I wanted to study, then for me, education was the biggest gift. I was basically swimming in it, devouring it, if you will.
So you are quite prolific. You have hundreds of patents and have started more than 20 companies. And I'm really curious about the pattern matching that goes with that. I, you know, have listened to some of the interviews with Sam Altman and others about Y Combinator and how they think the biggest asset they bring is the ability to pattern match and pick the teams that might have a chance of really winning big. When you encounter a new idea, what's your process for deciding whether it's an interesting but not very promising idea or something really that's worth betting on?
For somebody to be able to do this over and over again, you cannot be the guy or the gal who focuses on the details. You have to be looking at the bigger dots that you need to connect. Steve Jobs said this, the dots are a lot easier connecting looking backwards.
Right.
They're much more difficult getting connected looking forward. But if you have the ability to connect the dots looking backwards, you kind of have a sense of the slope of the curve. So you may not be able to point out the dots in the future, but you kind of have a sense of where the curve is going. And so you actually orient yourself to the direction of the curvature.
And I know we'll talk in a little bit about Imperative Care, your venture that you're involved with right now. But let's say you were not involved with that. What would be some of the future dots or future things that you're starting to notice? What are some of the patterns you're seeing in the future that you think are creating opportunity?
One very specific one I like to talk about, and one that is much broader, and maybe I'm going over my skis a little bit on that one, but I'm going to share it with you anyways. The one that I think is clear, present, and here and now, that should be an area of innovation for the future is women's health. part of it, I happen to believe, has to do with the fact that it feels like a taboo to have for women to be able to talk about women health issues. It's not talked about broadly in the way that it's supposed to. And if you don't know what problem you're solving for, then you're really not going after solving the problem, if you will.
Is it that women don't talk about it or men don't hear it?
I think it's both, but I think it's mostly women don't talk about it because they feel like they get stigmatized. That they're defective or something like that. Women reproductivity paradigm, so to speak, when it looks like it's not working, it may be viewed as defective as opposed to kind of recognizing that there's a problem there to solve. And if you have the right input, we may actually be able to get the right output. But I think it's also because of men. Men are afraid of hearing about women's health issues. They don't know how to process it. And so I think this is where the opportunity for the future is. This is where I say that we need more women in the decision-making process of medical innovation and the future and in healthcare in general, basically. I feel like from a pattern standpoint, that's one of the greatest opportunities that we have. On a bigger pattern perspective, the system of healthcare in the U.S., particularly as it comes to the commercial side of healthcare, is very much built based on utilization, not outcomes. Subspecialties, utilization of technology, pharmaceuticals, and what have you. That system has done amazingly, of course, to get us here and advancement of medicine. But I think we've actually come to a point where we're hitting a plateau. When I came, Claudia, to the U.S., the share of the GDP that was going to healthcare was about 3%. This is in 1978. The share of the GDP that was being spent on military, this is back in the Soviet Union days, basically, was upwards of about 13%. Today, those numbers are reversed. We're spending 2, 3% on military. We're spending about 18% on healthcare. And unless you can actually put yourself on a private jet and go to the Mayo Clinic and get an expensive $1 million executive care, you're not going to get connected care. What I'm realizing is that diseases are almost like an elephant, and all the subspecialties are close to that elephant. Nobody sees it completely. Nobody really backs away from the elephant to see the total problem. Somebody sees the tusk, somebody sees the bum, somebody sees the side. And the question is, who will adjudicate what needs to be done to you as a patient? It needs to be connected. It needs to be connected care. There's a paradigm in the future where outcomes become the primary focus. Utilization will follow outcomes. But in order to actually go into that paradigm of focusing on outcomes, we need connected care. After every one of these periods of turmoil that we have, globally, so to speak, humanity, both the economy propels forward after each one of these. We're in one right now. We just don't know where the bottom is. But when we hit the bottom and come out of it, the economy, the global economy is going to advance, but humanity advances in a significant way. Right before the Second World War, the percentage of people who could read and write in the world was 11% to 12%. Today it's 80-some percent. But we came out of the Second World War, the standards of literacy in the world propelled in a way that it changed humanity. We came out of the Cold War, at the time of Russians are coming, right? Essentially, that led to democratization of information to everybody. internet, access to information. Somebody in Afghanistan has the same access to information as you and I do. There's information that at times, basically before this democratization, was probably available to the CIA, KGB, MI6, and some of the deep intelligence agencies right now is democratized and available to everybody. Some bad information also. Some fake information is available to people. But information has been democratized. At every one of these stages, there's a humanity gets propelled to the next stage. And I believe that this notion of connected care that AI will usher with, along with life sciences innovation, is going to be the next advancement in humanity that we're going to see over the next 10 to 20 years.
I couldn't agree more that we need a different form of payment organization. And as a former policymaker, I've seen so many attempts at what we call value-based care be hopeful and then be dashed and grow a little and then stagnate. One of the challenges is that every one of those dollars is going in somebody's paycheck. And so the kind of disruption required to move the 18% of the economy to a different model is extremely substantial. But I like where you're going, because I actually think the disruption of AI almost offers an opportunity to say, well, we have to engage with that. But I have come out of the last 10 years somewhat cynical about our ability to actually digest and move forward in a different way. I agree with you that there's something different that's going on right now.
And all I'm saying is that I think you're absolutely well-placed to be cynical about it. But I think AI is going to change that. I think that the notion of connected care is going to change that. And right now, the reason you're cynical and I'm cynical about it also is that the incentives in the healthcare system, as you pointed out, somebody's paycheck is associated with it. The point that I'm making is not about reducing that 18% of the GDP. The point that I'm making is, if we're going to spend 18% of the GDP on healthcare, we better feel really, really good about it, and it better improve outcomes of patients.
Taking this same topic of the government, I was struck by something you said, which actually echoed a conversation I had with Rob Califf. People like to bash the government and regulation as what's slowing innovation down. And in some cases, that's true. But I think one of the points you've made is that regulation, and especially high standards and predictability, are actually market makers when it comes to biomedical innovation in the U.S. And I'd just love to have you paint that picture a little bit more for the listeners.
I happen to believe that the reason American medical technology and American pharmaceuticals are the most sought after in the world, if you can afford it, is because of the FDA. I like to say it's because of entrepreneurs like me, and it is. It's because of everybody who's actually working so hard on it. But you could not achieve that. We could not achieve the results that we're achieving around the world, and that sought after nature, if you will, if it weren't for the systems of standards and highest quality level thinking, so to speak, that the FDA is bringing to the table. Medical devices is one of the areas of, or medical technology and life sciences in general, pharmaceuticals, biotech, happens to be an area of innovation that is so indigenous to the United States, is because of the FDA. If we take that away, the standards will come down, and we're going to be essentially at the same level as all the other work that's being done in life sciences around the world, if you will.
Let me ask you about imperative care. This company really pulls the same strings you were talking about. The idea being, let's have a solution for stroke care, for that really is holistic, that covers the whole journey from soup to nuts, and that's comprehensive in treating various diseases and conditions. I'd love to hear how that idea came about and what the structure of a company, a set of products looks like that actually accomplishes that.
Think of Imperative Care as a company that is actually focused on one disease that is actually multiple clinical and commercial call points. It's head to toe. So it's whenever clot, mm-hmm. a piece of clot, lodges in an artery or a vein that prevents either oxygen getting to a distal organ or backs up blood so that the blood doesn't actually clear out. If that clot is in the brain, it's a stroke. If that clot is in the lung, it's a pulmonary embolism. If that clot is in the heart, it's a myocardial infarction. And if that clot is in the legs, it's deep vein thrombosis or DVT. It's all the same disease. The only thing that's different between these four or five diseases, basically, is the degree of acuteness of the disease. The farther up in the extremities you go, the more acute the treatment has to be. Within seconds to minutes, if it's in the brain, you have to clear the clot. Otherwise, the patient is either going to die or is going to have permanent, irreversible motor function limitations. In the lungs and in the heart, it's within minutes to hours that you have to treat. In the legs, it's between hours to days. They're all time-based. In all cases, the clot has to be removed to open up the pathway for blood to actually get to an end organ or get cleared. The vision of the company, Imperative Care, came from a physician, Dr. Nick Hopkins. And Nick's personality was very interesting. He thought by bringing people together, you create collision of ideas. Mm. And out of collision of ideas, there's always innovation that happens. But he never really considered himself a businessman. He always denied that he knew anything about business, even though he was sitting on the board of these companies. But at the moments where a clinical perspective could make a difference, make or break difference for the company, where the investors would either run away from the company or double down on the company, he would pipe up and give a perspective that would basically change the direction of the company. That's the kind of impact that he had. He was a neurosurgeon. He was a pioneer of the field of neurointervention. He actually created one of the first fellowships where he taught neurosurgeons to actually go through vascular intervention, learning techniques that interventional cardiologists only knew at the time to bring it to neurosurgery. He was the pioneer of that. In 2015, he ended up getting cancer. He was at the Mayo Clinic getting treated. I went and actually visited him, just to visit a friend. This was not supposed to be a business meeting.
But let's remember, he claims he never does business.
Yeah, exactly. So Nick actually came from his daily therapy and chemo, and we met and had a cup of coffee. And he then focused on selling me on the fact that we have to solve this problem of thromboembolism, and the fact that it's an acute disease. And we are in a healthcare ecosystem and dynamic and markets that are all focused on chronic disease. Dealing with acute disease is very different. One of the things that he was pointing out to me is that when somebody has a clot in an artery and you go, assuming you actually can clear the clot and take it out, that's not the end of that patient's problem. That's just the beginning. You still have a lot of debris and damage that you have to fix in the process. And so he believed that it's a misunderstood disease. It's an acute disease that is actually being treated and taken care of with chronic disease paradigms. And in order to actually do it the right way, you have to see it from a head-to-toe standpoint as an acute disease. So this technology called thrombectomy, which has been around for 20 years now, that essentially are very sophisticated tubes that go into the arteries, basically, and you can actually suck the clot out. Thrombectomy has been around for 20 years, but it's only available to the 20% in the U.S., 20% of the population that's eligible to get thrombectomy, because it's a sophisticated enough of a treatment that is only available in metropolitan areas. This was Nick Hopkins's vision. The way he was talking to me about it, it felt like it's something that he wanted to accomplish, and he was working against time. And so we are, as a company, focused on all of these diseases, basically, stroke, pulmonary embolism. We're going to be in the coronaries. We're actually in the DVT space, basically. And in all of these areas, where other companies are also participating, what we're trying to do is actually make the therapy faster, because it's all about time. And while making them faster, reduce vascular injuries. So since the advent of our first product in the U.S. market, basically called the Zoom Stroke Solution in 2020, we've reduced vascular injuries with our products by about six-folds.
Wow.
We've reduced the use of stent retrievers, which are stents that you pull, catch the clot and pull down and cause vascular injuries, by an order of magnitude, from 50% down to 5%. And we've reduced the time of these procedures from 45 minutes to an hour and a half, down to about a median of 19 minutes, with a third of the patients being able to get their clots out, basically, in less than 10 minutes.
Wow.
That's the impact that we've made to the process. Now, the problem of accessibility, you cannot solve by making the catheters faster or the doctors faster. There's still a problem of accessibility. So we have actually embarked on a very ambitious program of actually creating a robot where you could do this procedure remotely. So in all of the cath labs where there's no thrombectomy capability, you could actually put a robot where it could be driven remotely from the cath labs where you have the thrombectomy expertise and capabilities, so that the patients who actually show up at those regional hospitals get treated first, get their clots out first, take the clot out, then you can actually transport them to the comprehensive stroke center. Because every minute that that clot is there for stroke, for example, 2 million axons die. Every 15 minutes that that clot is there, 10% of brain's function permanently shuts down, irreversible and permanently. Thrombectomy was first developed, first used in first patient 20 years ago. In 20 years, we've actually addressed 20% of the population. If we go by that trend, by the time we get to 80% of the U.S. population, it'll be 2080. That to us was unfathomable. And so what we're trying to do is actually really compress this time down so that in the 2030s, we actually have an opportunity to be able to address most of thromboembolic disease in the U.S. and eventually globally.
We're coming to the end, and I want to close out in a circling back to the conversation we started with. I was really, really affected by some of the things you said about being an immigrant. And you often quote President Reagan in one of his speeches, and this is a bit of a collapsing of what he said, but he said, "It is bold men and women yearning for freedom and opportunity who leave their homelands and come to a new country to start their lives over. They believe in the American dream. They understand in a special way how glorious it is to be an American." And I'd just love to have you talk about what that means to you personally.
We need to go back to an environment where we really care for one another, as opposed to being in the atmosphere of division that we are in today. I feel like the future is going to be about the greatest asset, the greatest currency that humanity will have in the future is going to be humanity itself. It's going to be how much we care about each other. That's going to transcend machines, algorithms, and everything else. It's going to be the greatest currency.
Well, in your spirit of pattern making into the future, that's a great place to end. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It was a lovely discussion.
What stayed with me most from this conversation was Fred's immigrant story. It's a powerful reminder of something fundamental. American strength and prosperity were built by immigrants. Immigrants like Fred, who arrive with nothing and thrive in the freedom and opportunity found in America. They bring talent, grit, imagination, and an extraordinary capacity to make opportunities for themselves and others. His story is a testament to the promise of America when it's at its best. This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Fred Kasrabi. There is more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.